This is Functional Medicine Update for January 2009, Volume 29, Number 1. We begin the new year with a focus on extracellular physiology and connective tissue. Topics covered this month will include bone loss and estrogen, cell biology of bone metabolism, the WNT signaling transduction pathways, the bone formation process, bone's impact on total system biology, intracellular transduction, serotonin, and the gut talking to bone. Our interview this month is with Dr. Helene Langevin, discussing her work on extracellular matrix physiology. Now here's Dr. Jeffrey Bland in the January edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to January 2009 Functional Medicine Update. The start of a new year, the start of a new age, the start of a new period of opportunity. So let's start this new age with a very, very interesting concept that I think makes functional medicine stand up in the clinic in a way that probably previously we would have never even dreamed possible. I'll start with a quote. Unspecialized loose connective tissue forms an anatomical network throughout the body. We recognize now that connective tissue functions as a body-wide mechanosensitive signaling network. Three categories of signals are included, including electrical, cellular, and tissue remodeling, each potentially responsive to mechanical forces over different time scales. So begins a recent paper by Dr. Helene Langevin, Department of Neurology, University of Vermont College of Medicine, entitled Connective Tissue, a Body-Wide Signaling Network? You're going to have the pleasure to hear from Dr. Langevin directly in her pioneering work in the area of extracellular matrix physiology and looking at the mechanistic and cellular roles that mechanical and electrical stimulation has on whole body physiology. But before we get to Dr. Langevin and her pioneering work, I'd like to set the context of what to me is emerging to be one of the most remarkable stories that gives substance to the concepts of functional medicine that we've been describing now for over 20 years. And that's the story that surrounds an aspect of this connective tissue, this collagenous matrix that holds us together, that we've thought of as being a structural component of the body, but now we recognize it's a composite not only of structure but function, because it participates in transduction of signals. Signals from the environment deeply then transduced into the interior of cells, to the very heart of the cell where our book of life resides within the library called our genome, that then unlocks portions of our library to read certain chapters in our book of life to create the stories that become the phenotype of those cells and alter function as a consequence. This mechanism of mechanical transduction of signals to the interior of cells to produce different function is now an extraordinary new component of the evolving understanding of what we've really meant about a systems biology approach to medicine that we call functional medicine. And it's with that in mind that we're going to focus this month's issue of Functional Medicine Update on that related to extracellular matrix physiology and related to connective tissue. And the place to start this discussion has to do with a condition that we all think we know quite a bit about, osteoporosis. But I'd like to cast the term osteoporosis through the lens of the functional medicine matrix to produce a different sense as to what is emerging to be understood about osteoporosis, the relative loss of bone over time, with increased risk to fracture. So let's start with just the presumption that osteoporosis is partly related to things like calcium nutriture, vitamin D status, vitamin K status, the relationship to estrogens and other hormones. We know that these factors play a role in maintenance of bone integrity, But we also recognize that bone loss leading to decreased bone mineral reserve and reduced integrity of the bone mineral matrix can occur as a consequence of inflammatory conditions, such that postmenopausal osteoporosis, could it be more than just the loss of estrogen that then induces some kind of an anabolic change in the bone remodeling unit? But could it be considered, in part, an autoimmune disease? Now, why do I bring that up? I bring that up because it's now being recognized that there is a role of T cells and the relationship of their secreted inflammatory mediator, which is tumor necrosis factor alpha, along with other cytokines, in the pathogenesis of bone loss, which occurs in systemic inflammatory diseases. The relevance of these T-cell activities in bone loss due to estrogen deficiency has been investigated now by a number of different groups that have shown in recent years that the increased presence of TNF-alpha-producing T-cells is essential for the changes in bone metabolism during estrogen deficiency, and that the lack of estrogen increases the secretion of interferon gamma by helper T-cells, through which complex class 2 related expression of major histocompatibility class 2 antigens then enhances the activation and proliferation of the TNF-alpha producing T-cells. Therefore, in part, we would say, is then osteoporosis an autoimmune disease, or is it a problem related to an isolated difficulty in the bone itself? In other words, does it have a systemic connection, or is it a localized problem that is seen only in bone? Well, those are very interesting questions, aren't they? Because that moves us beyond looking at individual organ parts, in this case the skeleton, in isolation of the rest of the body, to looking at the skeleton in the context of what we call systems biology, from a functional approach. And in order to better understand that connection of estrogen and mechanical stress or exercise, weight-bearing exercise as it's often said, or resistance exercise, or nutrition of calcium or magnesium or phosphorus or vitamin D on bone metabolism, we have to know something about the cell biology of bone metabolism itself. And that's really advancing dramatically in terms of our understanding of how the bone remodeling unit works at the cellular and even molecular level. So let's dig a little deeper into this question about the cellular biology of bone metabolism for a second. There's a wonderful review that was just published in 2008 in the Journal of Clinical Pathology, volume 61, page 577 in 2008, entitled The Cell Biology of Bone Metabolism. And as we recognize, bone in the macro look is a specialized connective tissue that's hardened by mineralization with a mineral called calcium phosphate in the form of hydroxyapatite. We know that it has rigidity and shape, and it protects and supports the body, but it's more than that. Contrary to popular belief, bone is in fact a highly dynamic structure undergoing constant remodeling throughout the whole of our life, and in fact is an integral part of the neuroendocrine immune system. Now, you heard what I just said. Let me say it again. Bone is an integral part of the neuroendocrine immune system. Now, that's a different perspective on looking at skeletal health and integrity. And we'll come back, obviously, to talk much more why I think that position is now justified in light of what we've learned about bone metabolism and the cellular biology of bone. So, to make a simple story out of a much more complex topic, bone status is regulated in part by the activity of two different cell types, the osteoblast, which produces new bone, and the osteoclast that's involved with resorption. In youth, we have osteoblastic activity exceeding that of osteoclastic activity, and we have net skeletal accretion. In midlife, we'd like to think that our bone resorption equals that of our bone reformation, and so we have a long period of skeletal homeostasis under constant remodeling. It's a little bit like the hummingbird flapping its wings. It looks as if the bone is staying in the same state, but actually if we were to look at it with time-lapse photography, what we would see is remodeling of the bone occurring all the time with new bone replacing old and maintaining a net skeletal equilibrium. And then in older age, we know osteolysis exceeds that of osteogenesis, and we start to get skeletal loss. That can occur, however, even in younger age. with specific types of disorders that are associated with osteoclastogenesis, where you actually see the osteoclast exceeding in its activity and number that of the osteoblast. So we have a net skeletal resorption. Now, what causes this to occur? Be it either in the alveolar bone of the jaw or the mandible, or the trabecular bone of the spine, or the cancellous bone of the wrist. What is it that results in this dynamic equilibrium and the shift between osteoclastic and osteoblastic activity? Well, I think that is really the theme of this new emerging understanding of the cell biology of bone. If we look at the ultimate activity at the bone remodeling unit, at the osteoclast and the osteoblastic cell, what we'll find is that there are many, many different signal transduction agents that are involved in signaling to the book of life, the genome, within those cell types, what they're going to express in terms of proteins that then regulate their function. This intracellular signal transduction process within the bone remodeling unit is regulated by exposure to environmental factors as well as the genetics of that individual. And that signal transduction process is emerged to be much more complex than we ever would have believed, in that it is influenced by, and it also influences, activities within the nervous, immune, and endocrine systems. So factors that would be considered hormones or inflammatory mediators or even mechanical signals can all influence the regulatory signal transduction within these cell types that make up the bone remodeling unit. And then those activities of the bone remodeling unit cells secrete within to the plasma substances that have influence downstream on other tissues and influence the neuroendocrine immune system in other places of the body. So it's a feedback process. It's once again a system of biological function. Bone doesn't work in isolation. Now let's look a little bit more in detail at these signal transduction agents that regulate the expression of genes that ultimately control the phenotype of bone and may have influence on other functions of the body that I'm going to go into in a moment. One of the principal processes in the signal transduction process related to skeleton and bone formation is the so-called WNT-beta catenin system that then connects together with bone morphogenic protein pathways and how that then modulates key transcription factors within the regulatory units of the genome of these bone cells. So the WNT beta catenin signal transduction process becomes a very important part of the process. It regulates then osteoblastic activity and its interrelationship with osteoclastic activity. Now, I'm going to talk about this in more detail, and I want to make this fairly complex story as easy to understand as possible. So I will ask for a little poetic license here in that there is a very significant levels of detail below which I'm going to be speaking. So I'm going to take a kind of a higher level view. But what I'm really saying is that the regulatory factors, the nuclear regulatory factors that control the expression of genes within the osteoblast and osteoclastic cells are influenced by environmental factors that then signal through the WNT beta catenin signaling pathway. And therefore, if we wanted to understand something about ultimately what's seen clinically as a bone demineralizing situation, we'd want to know something about its upstream regulatory effects on the signal transduction processes. And we're going to be focusing both on the WNT and beta catenin pathways, and then we're also going to be looking in the osteoclastic cell, the bone resorbing unit, at another interesting signal transduction pathway that is called the receptor of NF-kappa-B ligand, receptor of NF-kappa-B ligand pathway, or RANKL. Receptor of NF-kappa-B ligand, because on the surface of the osteoclastic cell resides a receptor site, so-called receptor of NF-kappa-B, which then binds to the receptor of NF-kappa-B ligand. So that RANKL-RANK ligand interaction forms a complex that then signals into the osteoclastic cell down through a signal transduction process that ultimately causes NF-kappa-B to translocate to the nucleus and upregulate in the osteoclastic cell the production of factors that lead to bone resorption, or osteoclastogenesis, where you actually increase the activity and number of the osteoclastic cells at the expense of lowering the activity of the osteoblastic cells. So the WNT beta-catenin signaling pathway regulates to some extent osteoblastogenesis, which means increasing bone reformation, whereas the Rankl-Rank signal transduction pathway activates osteoclastogenesis. It regulates primarily that of bone resorption. I hope this is becoming at least somewhat understandable now. So environmental factors that activate the Rankl system are then involved with bone loss, whereas those that activate the WNT beta-catenin system are more related to bone reformation. The Rankl system, the receptor event of kappa B ligand, is an inflammatory mediated pathway down through NF-kappa B, translocating to the nucleus of the osteoclast and upregulating the expression of genes that then regulate osteoclastogenesis and bone resorption. The WNT pathway is a pathway that is regulated by many environmental factors that I'm going to go into discuss, including weight-bearing exercise, mechanical stimulus, including various hormones like vitamin D in its hormonal form, 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D3, and estrogen, and including a variety of other signal transduction agents that may be nutritionally derived, for which we have only recently started to recognize that they play a role in bone maintenance. In fact, they would not be on the short list of most people who think of various nutritive factors that are associated with that of bone regulation. In other words, phytochemicals that might favorably influence the WNT beta-catenin signaling pathway in osteoblastogenesis. Now, it's further important to understand that the osteoblast and osteoclast equilibrium is just that of an equilibrium. You can shift this teeter-totter towards more osteoclasts and higher activity resorption by activating the Rankl system, whereas you can shift the teeter-totter the other way towards more osteoblastic formation and more bone formation by activating the WNT beta-catenin system. So this is a regulatory intercellular signal transduction pathway that then is influenced and communicates with the outside world with environmental factors, both that of endogenous substances like hormones and exogenous substances or activities or functions, including things like mechanical transduction or energy medicine. Now, with all of that as kind of a summary background, let's now talk about what this skeletal remodeling unit that's composed of the osteoblast and osteoclast does, both locally and systemically. Locally, it's going to regulate the structure and function of both cancellous and trabecular bone, the formation of this spongy bone that is porous. It has these caniculi and forms a very high tensile strength structure that is actually very lightweight compared to its strength because of this architecture of the bone that's regulated not just by the calcification with hydroxyapatite, but by the bone mineral matrix itself as supported by the protein that is the structural protein, the connective tissue protein that regulates the ultimate structure and function and strength of the bone. So we have the local effects of this process on bone strength and function. Beyond that, however, it's been recognized now that this healthy bone or unhealthy bone is secreting substances that go into systemic circulation as a consequence of the bone's response to its environment that then influences tissues at a distance. Now, what am I really speaking about? If you recall, it was last year in Functional Medicine Update that I talked about this remarkable paper that appeared in the journal Cell in the August 2007 issue entitled Endocrine Regulation of Energy Metabolism by the Skeleton. This was work that came out of the Department of Pathology and Genetics at Columbia University and College of Physicians and Surgeons, looking at the role that various factors that were secreted by bone could have on things like the endocrine pancreas, beta cells, the islets of Langerhans cells that secrete insulin, or the adipocyte cell that secretes adiponectin. And what it was found is that a substance called osteocalcin that was secreted by the osteoblastic cell upon stimulation by the WNT beta-catenin intracellular signal transduction process, that substance, osteocalcin, in an uncarboxylated form, had positive impacts on the adipocyte, secreting adiponectin, which is, as you know, anti-inflammatory and insulin sensitizing. It had also positive effects on the beta cells of the endocrine pancreas in secreting more insulin, in fact, leads to proliferation of the beta cells. And so it leads to what? Improved insulin stability, improved glucoregulation, and improved appetite regulation, and improved weight. So people started saying, now hold just a minute. Are you saying that the skeleton has a role to play in energy regulation of the whole body and has an endocrine-like effect by regulating influences on beta cell activity within the pancreas and adipocytokine production that then influence things like appetite? And the answer is yes. That's what has been seen. And in fact, it's now recognized that the signal transduction process that controls the secretion of osteocalcin by the osteoblast is regulated by an ESP gene. The gene's called ESP. And that gene then ultimately is controlled by various types of environmental factors. That if you have ESP gene activities, either up or down regulated, it then has an influence on whether osteocalcin will be more produced or less produced by the osteoblast, which then has an effect on either improving or decreasing insulin production and sensitivity and increasing or decreasing adiponectin production by the adipocyte. Now, these are really profound new thoughts about systems biology and medicine, and we want to talk about structure and function. We've moved now to a understanding of cellular physiology that has a whole body context. Moving beyond the bone as a structural unit sitting in isolation, we've now moved to bone as being an active contributing member to the overall neuroendocrine immune system, regulating far-ranging functions such as appetite, insulin sensitivity, glucose, and even anti-inflammatory proteins such as adiponectin. By the way, there's a very nice review of this whole energy regulation by the skeleton that's authored by George Wolf from Berkeley, that appeared in Nutrition Reviews, Volume 66, page 229 in 2008, that I think you might find very helpful if you want to read more about this topic. So it seems like we're starting to emerge a different view of how the skeleton is part of an overall systems biology relationship and what we might see as unhealthy bone, bone that means we have increased osteoclastogenesis with increased bone resorption, is reflective not only of increased risk to osteoporotic fracture, but also it's reflective of maybe systemic problems related to difficulties with regard to insulin sensitivity, to difficulties related to appetite regulation and adipocytokine production, difficulties related to inflammatory conditions. So it's a push-pull. Inflammation increases osteoclastogenesis. Increased osteoclastogenesis then has a feed-forward effect on supporting increased inflammation. So we're into a chronic cycle of inflammatory disorder. Now, just to follow up on this to show you that extraordinary work is continuing in this area, in the August 2008 issue of Nature, there was a very interesting additional paper published. This is out of the section on obesity and hormone action at the Joslin Diabetes Center at Harvard. This was entitled New Role of Bone Morphogenic Protein 7, or BMP7, in Brown Adipogenesis and Energy Expenditure. Now, you remember I talked about two signal transduction pathways playing very important roles in osteoblastogenesis. One was that of the WNT beta-catenin pathway, and the other was this bone morphogenic protein pathway and its relationship with transforming beta. And this whole process of osteoclastogenesis versus osteoblastogenesis is then, as I indicated, regulated by the way that these signals are transduced at the cellular level. So what does this paper in Nature tell us? Well, it follows on the energy regulation by the skeleton theme. As we all know, adipose tissue, or the adipocyte mass, is central to the regulation of energy balance. It's what fat is supposedly there to do, is to kind of store energy for a rainy day in the form of triglycerides. two functionally different types of fat are present, we know. One is called white adipose tissue, which is the primary site of where fats as triglycerides is stored. And also, we have the brown adipose tissue. These are more metabolically active forms of fat cells that are specialized in energy expenditure related to thermogenesis, and they can counteract obesity. It's been said that a human adult has somewhere around 30 grams or 1 ounce of brown fat that's very important for maintenance of their core temperature and having thermogenic response to calories to maintain proper body weight. Factors that specify the development and fate of the function of white and brown adipose tissue still remain poorly understood. However, it's now recognized that the family of bone morphogenic proteins support white adipocyte differentiation and that bone morphogenic protein 7 singularly promotes differentiation of brown pre-adipocytes even in the absence of other hormonal inductions. And bone morphogenic protein 7 coming from bone activates a full program of brown adipogenesis, including induction of early regulators of brown fat fate, increasing then the thermogenic activity and influencing then energy economy of the body, so the skeleton can regulate energy expenditure. So healthy bone is healthy body. Healthy body is a system of biology that produces a high function. It's impossible, in light of what's emerging in the basic clinical sciences, to look at disease as organ-specific in isolation. We have to start, obviously, looking at things as networked, as interactions, as systems, where we get these interactive components that then set up new cycles of harmonics, and those harmonics become steady states that we call, for the lack of a better understanding, a disease. So let me go back now to where we started this discussion, and that is intracellular signal transduction. Now, for those of you that are not cellular biologists or molecular biologists, let me try to take another run at this just so we all are on the same page. When I say signal transduction, what I'm speaking to are processes within a cell that take outside information in the form of agents that would signal to the cell. They could be mechanical signals, electrical signals, or chemical signals that then are picked up by receptor sites or signal transduction proteins that are generally involved with a family of proteins that we call kinases, which are phosphorylating proteins, and that they modulate like a relay race, runners then passing the baton from one runner to the other, by repetitive phosphorylation cascades, so that this signal gets transduced from outside the cell then to the inside of the cell through the cytoplasm, ultimately through the nuclear envelope into the nucleus where the genome resides and even into the mitochondria, the energy powerhouse of the cell. So these transduction processes that are mediated or modulated through these kinase enzyme signaling relay racers, I guess we call them, then result in altered structure and function of the cell. So WNT and beta-catenin are an important signaling transduction pathway, these proteins, to regulate then as nuclear regulatory factors, the expression within the nucleus on the cassette of genes that regulate osteoblastic cell function, a specific constellation of proteins that then cause bone reformation. So the WNT genes then encode a highly conserved class of signaling factors required for the development of musculoskeletal and neural structures. There is increasing evidence that WNT signaling is critical for bone mass accrual, bone remodeling, and fracture repair. WNT proteins bind to cell surface receptors and activate signaling pathways which control the nuclear gene expression. And this WNT-regulated gene expression controls cell growth and differentiation. Now, with all of that in mind, then we might ask, well, how can you alter WNT function and what role does WNT play in this process? Well, WNT is going to stabilize once it's produced, this pathway is activated. It stabilizes a process within the osteoblastic cell that's going to engage then in osteoblastogenesis, increased osteoblastic activity, and increased bone formation activity. So we're going to actually see a positive influence of WNT stabilizing the target genes or activating the target genes involved with osteoblastogenesis. What that would mean is if you had no WNT activity or inhibited WNT activity, that that would result in reduced osteoblastogenesis, whereas activated WNT would lead to increased osteoblastogenesis. So you might ask, are there people that are born with increased WNT signaling pathways, and what influence does that have on their bone? And the answer is yes, there are those genetic unique individuals, and they have very dense bones. What about people on the opposite that have low WNT signaling pathways as a consequence of their genetics? And the answer is yes, those are also have been identified, things like osteoporosis, pseudoglioma, and those are associated with early onset, very serious bone demineralization issues. So we know that these genetic outliers do exist to confirm the importance of the WNT pathway. The WNT pathway then regulates at the cellular level the expression into the phenotype of these particular aspects of osteoblastogenesis and how that then interrelates with osteoclastogenesis. Now, with all of that in mind, now the question is, what regulates the WNT pathway? Are there things upstream of that that we should be considerate of? And here is where the story gets unbelievably interesting. In fact, this has got to be considered upon the publication of this paper that appeared in Cell in November of 2008 to be one of those I can't believe it kind of responses by the scientific community. Because it turns out that within this complex signaling pathway, that one of the things that stabilizes WNT or destabilizes WNT signaling is a hormone that we're very familiar with, that we've heard much about, that has to do with mood, and that hormone is called serotonin. Serotonin, we know, is synthesized within the central nervous system. It's a neurotransmitter. But you probably recognize that the principal place where serotonin is synthesized in the body happens to be in the enterochromaffin cells in the small intestine and duodenum. In fact, almost two-thirds of the body's serotonin comes from the gut. We learned this years ago from Dr. Michael Gershon in his classic book, The Second Brain, talking about GI hormonal function. And serotonin synthesis in the gut then contributes significantly to the level of serotonin in the blood. In fact, the majority of blood serotonin didn't emerge from the central nervous system. It emerged from the gut. Now, the gut serotonin does not cross the blood-brain barrier, so it doesn't lead to mood elevation, but it does have impacts on cellular function beyond that of mood itself. And this is where the story gets extraordinarily interesting. Because in the November 28, 2008 issue of Cell, volume 135, page 825, an article was published, again out of Columbia University, collaboration among the genetics department, neuroscience and psychiatry and pharmacology departments, that was entitled, Lipoprotein Receptor 5 Controls Bone Formation by Inhibiting Serotonin Synthesis in the Duodenum. Now, what is that all about? Well, this is a very, very extraordinary part of the story. Let me, if I can, show you how it connects to our WNT beta-catenin regulation of osteoblastogenesis. Loss and gain of function mutations in the broadly expressed gene, this lipoprotein receptor 5, have been known for some time to affect bone formation. There's a wide body of literature that is from molecular genetics and animal biology to demonstrate that. That then causes osteoporosis in the loss of function, or it can result in high bone mass in the gain function. Lipoprotein receptor 5 has been viewed as a WNT co-receptor, an osteoblast-specific disruption of the beta-catenin does not affect bone formation. In this paper, however, the one I'm just describing in Cell, they demonstrated that this lipoprotein receptor 5 inhibits the expression of another interesting gene, TPH1. And what does TPH1 do? TPH1 controls, it's the rate-limiting control of the biosynthetic enzyme tryptophan hydroxylase that then results in the formation of serotonin in the enterochromaffin cells of the duodenum. Now, what am I really saying to you? I'm saying that when you have elevated serotonin production at the gut level, you have increased bone loss by activating the osteoclastogenesis and reducing osteoblastogenesis because you block the WNT beta-catenin signaling process, and that the serotonin produced by the gut has a very dramatic effect then on increasing the potential for bone loss. And that's serotonin production in the enterochromaffin cells within the small intestine. So as the editorial that follows this article points out, the gut talks to bone. Does this at all sound familiar relative to the functional medicine and systems biology discussions we've been having over the last many years? In this particular editorial, they talk about these mutations in the lipoprotein receptor 5, this co-receptor of WNT protein, that then can result in, through the serotonergic signaling pathways, the altered effects of osteoblastogenesis, in other words, reducing bone reformation. So what is it that activates serotonin production through this process of the LRP5? And that's where we get to a very interesting connection to clinical medicine, because also in 2008, in Neurogastroenterology and Motility, another journal, it was reported that inflammatory signals associated with IL-1 beta and lipopolysaccharide-induced serotonin secretion was shown in the enterochromaffin cells derived from patients with Crohn's disease. So when we get into chronic inflammatory bowel diseases or conditions where the immune system of the gut is upregulated, we get increased production of inflammatory mediators that activate this regulatory pathway that's associated then with what? Suppression of WNT and osteoblastogenesis with increased systemic serotonin production and increased risk of bone loss. So here we have a condition of gut inflammation connected to bone loss, which is then connected to unhealthy bone, which is connected to lowered osteocalcin, lowered adiponectin, lowered insulin sensitivity, lowered insulin output, and increased obesity and type 2 diabetes. So these are very profound types of new network thinking. And if we couple that together with a paper that I described to you last year entitled "A High-Fat Meal Induces Low-Grade Endotoxemia, Evidence of a Novel Mechanism of Postprandial Inflammation." You recall this appeared in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 36, page 1286 in 2007. In this particular paper, what the authors pointed out is if you take apparently healthy people and you feed them a high-fat, high-sugar meal, and you measure bacterial endotoxin in their plasma, you will find it circulating after the meal, indicating gut permeability and an upregulation of their inflammatory pathways at the gut immune level. And you can actually measure the increase in the inflammatory cytokines that occur after giving that person a high-fat, high-sugar meal. So what happens if people constantly activate the inflammatory pathway of their gut, increasing gut enterochromaffin cell production of serotonin, and bathe then the bone remodeling unit with increased serotonin that influences then ultimately the WNT signaling pathway and shifts the balance of osteoblastogenesis and osteoclastogenesis towards osteoclastic activity and bone loss? And that also couples together with what? Lowered osteocalcin production, increased inflammatory potential, lowered adiponectin, increased triglyceride storage, blunting of thermogenic effects on the brown fat. And now we shift that whole body archetype systemically into a person with central fat deposition, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, high triglycerides, cardiovascular risk, and so forth and so on, in which the treatment of choice in medicine has generally been to treat each of those outcome variables independently as if they were isolated rather than to look at the web of interacting variables. Or we can say it another way. Is there not a comorbidity between gut inflammatory conditions, autoimmune disease, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, and type 2 diabetes? That's a new way of looking at a systemic problem with a functional medicine lens. With that in mind, let's move to really what you've been looking forward to, an extraordinary visit with Dr. Helene Langevin.
Well, once again, we're at that place in functional medicine update that I know you, like I, look forward to with such great anticipation, and that's our clinician or researcher of the month portion of the issue. And, of course, this month, again, we're so fortunate to have a person I think we could call on both sides of the house, both a clinician and researcher, and actually a person whose interview I've looked forward to now for probably the better part of 3 years as I've been reading her work and becoming more and more fascinated with the way that she and her group are approaching this very complicated area, and the work is very high level. So that probably piques your interest as to who I'm speaking to. And I'm speaking to Dr. Helene Langevin, who is an associate professor of neurology at the University of Vermont College of Medicine, who has a very remarkable background, getting her MD at McGill University and doing neuroanatomy and neurochemistry at Cambridge, and then going on intern and residency in internal medicine at Johns Hopkins, and then endocrinology and metabolism at Johns Hopkins. So that's no small background in academic medicine and clinical medicine. And since then has been very, very actively involved in research in an area that I think for many, quote, traditionally trained physicians it may be considered like, wow, that's something I never thought about, which is the extracellular matrix, connective tissue, how that interfaces with various therapies that are mechanical and mechanical electric, like acupuncture. I mean, these are really very interesting questions that have sat, obviously, for thousands of years in the traditional Chinese medicine literature, but maybe have suffered for the lack of some of the Western intervention concepts or mechanistic concepts. And that's really where Dr. Langevin has made some extraordinary, very precise measurements with her group. And it's with great privilege and pleasure, then, Dr. Langevin, I'd like to introduce you to our listenership at Functional Medicine Update, and thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
So let's jump right into it. With that background that I just described, which is formidable, one might ask, how did you then move from that background to the perspective of wanting to look at this whole area of connective tissue, extracellular matrix, and the systems biology that connects the nervous system, immune system to the extracellular matrix? How did that happen?
Well, it was kind of an interesting path for me. I was practicing medicine. I was practicing internal medicine and endocrinology, and I had a lot of patients who had chronic pain, and I was finding myself quite powerless to do a whole lot about it. And a lot of people were asking me about whether they should be having alternative types of treatments like acupuncture. This was in the 1980s, and there were already quite a surprising number of people who were interested in that. And I met some acupuncturists, and I became interested in it and decided to study acupuncture. So I went actually to acupuncture school part-time, and I was intrigued by the whole completely alternative approach to looking at the problem. And it seemed to me that they were looking at the human being from a completely different point of view. I thought that was very interesting. So I started practicing acupuncture. But one of the things that really intrigued me when I was an acupuncture student was that they would teach you how to manipulate the needles, and then they would say that you had to feel what was happening at the interface between the needle and the tissue. And they would say you have to wait until something happens, and then you know that you have manipulated the needle enough and you stop. And I could really feel something happening under my fingers. The tissue seemed to be tightening. Something was changing mechanically, the interface between the needle and the tissue. And when I was asking my teachers, my acupuncture instructors, what was this due to? And they would say, well, it's a muscle, you know, contracting. But that did make sense because there are some acupuncture points on the body where I was inserting needles and there were no muscle there at all. And so the idea sort of trotted around in my mind that if this phenomenon was truly some kind of tissue contraction that was not due to a muscle contraction, then what could it be? The skin is not supposed to contract, and the connective tissues underneath the skin are not supposed to contract either. So I then moved to Burlington, Vermont, and one thing led to another. I sort of finally decided I need to really investigate that. and got a research grant to just simply try to measure the force that it takes to pull the needle out. And that was our first study, and we found that there was indeed, when after you manipulated a needle, it took more force to pull the needle out. And at that point, I had no idea what was causing this. And we did some studies in animals that showed that it was, in fact, the connective tissue that was winding around the needle and changing the mechanical interaction between the needle and the tissue. And then I really got interested in connective tissue because we also kind of looked at, well, the acupuncture points and found that there was a lot of connective tissue there. A lot of these acupuncture points and meridians are located in between muscles, sort of in intermuscular fascial planes. And it seemed like maybe this acupuncture map that people were drawing thousands of years ago, maybe it was an indication of where to put the needle if you wanted your needle to interact with connective tissue. And then I got completely fascinated with connective tissue, and now I'm really studying connective tissue, many aspects of it, way beyond acupuncture at this point. But acupuncture was kind of what got me into that. So that's the story.
Well, that's it's just an incredible story. I'm always reminded when I have the privilege of speaking to people like yourself that are seekers that there's some unique characteristic that defines people like yourself that make observations and are willing and courageous enough to kind of follow the process of inquiry to the next level against sometimes what might be considered barriers which holds other people back, because probably many people ask these questions, but then they just say, well, you know, no one seems to be interested in these questions, so I'll just move on. And and then somehow people like yourselves stop and use their resources, their experience, and their wisdom to really dig deep and find things that are unexpected discoveries. And, of course, you've done it. And the first two papers I read of yours were the paper that was in FASM Journal back in, I think it was about 2001, on mechanical signaling through connective tissue, the mechanism for the therapeutic effect of acupuncture. And the other was, I think, a paper in 2002 in the Anatomical Record on the relationship of acupuncture points and meridians to connective tissue planes. And when I read those papers, it just dawned on me, I mean, you helped guide me to this kind of aha-ism, saying, gee whiz, maybe the primacy of the cell that we use within biological thought that ultimately directs and focuses its energy into medicine is really not the right fundamental unit. Maybe we ought to be looking at this extracellular matrix as a fundamental unit of organization. So I think you've opened a lot of eyes through your work.
Well, I need to specify one thing that's important, I think, for listeners to realize, is that we identified many important things physiologically, we think, that mechanical stimuli, including acupuncture needle manipulation, due to the connective tissue. Connective tissue is mechanically responsive. It's really the fibroblasts within the tissue, the extracellular matrix, they constantly remodel and they respond to the mechanical stimulus. However, at this point, we still don't know what the mechanical effect of the needle on the connective tissue, what does it have to do with the therapeutic effect? So I think it's important to realize that that's still a work in progress. That first paper that you mentioned in FASEP was kind of the original paper where we laid out the hypothesis that, in fact, there could be mechanical signals that could be transmitted by the needle to the tissue via cellular mechanisms that people call mechanotransduction, which is the kind of basically transformation of a mechanical signal into a biochemical response or cellular response. But I'm still very much in the dark about how this could translate into a therapeutic response. And I think that's very important for people to realize that.
Thank you. I think that's a really a good caveat to put in. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about, in summary, the techniques that you've been using to dig down in this very complex area and try to tease out some of these answers, because your experimental methods, I think, are very, very novel, and it's not easy work, it looks like to me.
Well, yeah, we have to really go stepwise, and I think what right now we have kind of a three-pronged approach to this. The first thing is we've identified these really interesting responses of connective tissue to the needle, and that's almost like become a cell biology project. As a matter of fact, one of the grants that I have right now is to study the effect of mechanical stimulation on the fibroblasts, and we're just looking at cell biology almost purely. What are the fibroblasts doing? What are the mechanisms by which they're responding to the mechanical stimulation? What are the responses in terms of cytoskeletal remodeling, gene expression, protein expression, and changes in connective tissue physiology? So that's just basically stuff that is basic research, basically. We're just trying to understand how does the connective tissue interact and respond to the mechanical forces. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we're looking at chronic low back pain. Because the idea is, well, okay, if the needle is doing something to the tissue that is going to be translated into a therapeutic response, what is it that would be fixing? What is the problem that this mechanical stimulus would help correct? And the important thing right now, I think the reality is, we don't really know very much about what causes chronic musculoskeletal pain. We're still very much in the dark about the pathophysiology of the problem. A lot of people have musculoskeletal pain, and, well, you know, people have looked into the nervous system in terms of hypersensitization, psychological responses to pain, but the tissues themselves, we don't really know what is it in the tissues that could be contributing to the pain, and in particular, connective tissue has been very little looked at. So we're really interested. We have a study that's ongoing right now. We're looking at a group of subjects with chronic low back pain, and we're looking at them with ultrasound, and we're looking at the structure of the connective tissue to see if it's abnormal. And then our hypothesis is that because people who have chronic low back pain, they have pain, say they have an initial injury, and then they will change how they move, or they will move less, or they will change their movement patterns because it hurts to move. And because connective tissue is so exquisitely responsive to mechanical stimulation, it remodels. So it remodels in good ways and bad ways. So if we stop moving or if we change the way we move, we know that the connective tissue changes. For example, if you have an arm in a cast or shoulder injury and you stop moving your shoulder, you can get a buildup of connective tissue such that you lose your range of motion. Well, we're hypothesizing that the same thing occurs in the back, that in the low back pain, the connective tissue essentially fibroses or becomes thicker, and that that impairs the movement and it further contributes to the chronicity of the pain. We're also looking at how this tissue, if it's abnormal, how does it respond to the acupuncture needle mechanical stimulation? Are the responses different in people with low back pain versus people without low back pain? And then to link these two projects, we have an animal model where we actually induce connective tissue abnormalities under control conditions using a combination of inflammation and movement restriction. And then we see how we can impact that with mechanical stimulation.
So when I was reading your very, very interesting paper that you co-authored with Karen Sherman on the pathophysiological model for chronic low back pain integrating connective tissue and nervous system mechanisms, which appeared in Medical Hypothesis last year, I was kind of struck, and I'm sure you've been asked this question before, that not only does it seem like this argument connects or this story connects to acupuncture, but to other manipulative or physical forms of medicine like deep tissue therapy, Rolfing, I mean other things that may send signals through the fascia that implicate remodeling.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's very important that the mechanisms that we're studying are not restricted to acupuncture or to manual therapies. I think they might be common to a lot of manual therapies. Types of treatment beyond that, even movement therapies like yoga, for example, anything that stretches the tissue may have an effect on the connective tissue. So the acupuncture needle is an interesting way to mechanically stimulate the tissue because it's very focused. The needle can, first of all, penetrate quite deep. And when the acupuncturist manipulates the needle, they can impart actually some very high forces, but in a very, very focused manner to the connective tissue because the collagen fibers are actually winding around the needle and then the needle becomes mechanically coupled to the tissue. And then everything you do, when the acupuncture needle is manipulated up and down or sideways, it transmits a mechanical signal that can affect the deep connective tissue layers very precisely. On the other hand, manual therapies where you're applying your hands or fingers to the tissue, apply a combination of pressure and stretch. There's some differences, obviously, as to how these mechanical forces are applied to the body, but they still have something in common. And then, of course, movement-based therapies, yoga or Feldenkrais or Alexander technique, or techniques that show people how to move differently, also apply mechanical forces to the tissue, although this time it's the person themselves who's doing it. And so what we think is that some of the mechanisms that we're studying in terms of connective tissue responses could apply to all of these.
We want to talk about a model of integrative science. The paper that you authored, the lead author, I think, along with a variety of your colleagues, that included not only your work at the Department of Neurology, but the Department of Mechanical Engineering and the Department of Pharmacology, all at University of Vermont's College of Medicine, which was published in the American Journal of Physiology and Cellular Physiology in 2005, entitled Dynamic Fibroblast Cytoskeletal Response to Subcutaneous Tissue Stretch Ex Vivo and In Vivo. I mean, this is a very interesting model for a different kind of research than we've seen in the past.
Yeah, and we think it's important for several reasons. First of all, from the point of view of cell biology, I would say the vast, overwhelming majority of the work on the chemotransduction in cell biology is being done in cultured cells. These are cells that are fibroblasts or other types of cells that are grown on plastic dishes or collagen matrices or, you know, artificial environment. There are a lot of very interesting signaling pathways that are known to be activated by mechanical stimulation in cells, gene expression, all sorts of stuff that we know that cells do when they're mechanically stimulated. But what we have found is that when you look at fibroblasts in their own tissue environment, either in the ex vivo model, which is where we take a piece of connective tissue out of the body, we use a mouse model, so we look at the connective tissue, but it's the whole tissue with the fibroblasts in them. They're excised from the animal, and they're kept in a bath, in an organ bath, sometimes for as much as a couple of days, sometimes for just a few minutes or a few hours, but they're still in their environment. And we look at how the fibroblasts respond to mechanical stimulation, and we also look at them when the mechanical stimulus is applied in a live animal. And then we sacrifice the animal and then look at the cellular response, but the mechanical stimulus is applied when the animal is still alive. And we had a lot of surprises there when we compared how our fibroblasts were responding and how they even looked, even the morphological appearance of the fibroblasts looked quite different from the fibroblasts in the dish. So we think that when you're studying the effect of mechanical stimulation, it's really important that the mechanical environment of the fibroblast or the cell is maintained, because the fibroblasts growing in the dish are not necessarily going to respond the same way as if they were in the real tissue. So we think from a cell biology point of view, these are important models. And of course, from a translational research point of view, we think they're important because they will allow us to understand the effect of the dose of the mechanical stimulation, because obviously it's really important how much and how long, for example, tissue is stretched. Physical therapists know this in their practice. If you have somebody who has, say, for example, a contracture or connective tissue adhesions following an injury or scar or something like that, and you stretch the tissue just enough, that can cause the connective tissue to remodel and the range of motion to improve. But if you stretch too much, you can actually injure the tissue more and cause inflammation, and the person has more pain, and that can worsen the problem. But we don't really understand the mechanisms by which all this happens, and we don't know the dose. This is all things that people do by experience, empirically. Each practitioner knows what is enough and what is too much. But there's quite a lot of controversy. Like, for example, in sports medicine, it's very interesting now. Everybody used to stretch, you know, before sports events, right? Athletes and trainers would recommend a lot of stretching. And just recently, there's starting to be a whole bunch of publications saying that stretching actually sometimes can impair sports performance and does not prevent injury. And there are some even more recent studies that have begun to really look at how much people should stretch, because stretching too much can be detrimental. So I really think that this points to the importance of understanding the correct dose of mechanical stimulation that the tissue requires to be healthy, and also what could be a therapeutic dose if somebody is in a situation where their tissue is not healthy. What is the right dose to promote a healthy response in healing of an injury or in chronic pain, for example? What could be helpful to the patient?
That's a beautiful segue, actually, into a kind of a translational question. Being a multiple personality and background individual, all the way from your board certification in endocrinology, metabolism, and internal medicine to your being a licensed acupuncturist, so you've got your worldview on many different planes, what do you think the operator dependence is in, or the practitioner dependent component of being successful in implementing these? It would sound to me from what you said that there's a lot of art in the skill of understanding how to be part of this process with the patient, and the touch and the feel and the skill that comes from years of experience or whatever those characteristics are must be very important in outcome.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things that fascinates me, actually. Obviously, you could take an example. What makes a good acupuncturist and a not-so-good acupuncturist? acupuncturists typically and traditionally are trained by apprenticeship for generations and generations. In China and in Asian countries, acupuncturists typically would learn from their families, from their parents, their father, mother. They would get transmitted along the generations, the art and what types of techniques. And there's so many different ways to practice acupuncture. If you look at, for example, Japanese acupuncture versus Korean and Chinese acupuncture, people will use different depths of needle penetration, different amounts of stimulation. Some people turn the needle in one way. Some people do up and down combinations. And so we don't really know what works better for what condition. We're just beginning to scratch the surface, really, and trying to understand what works and what doesn't. One of the things that I'm interested in, actually, is developing some tools to record the technique, the needle technique, that an acupuncturist employs during treatment so that at least we can document what people do and try to understand quantitatively what is more effective in terms of acupuncture techniques. And the same really is true with manual therapies. I think there's a lot of efforts right now in the chiropractic community, in massage, and to develop techniques to actually measure the forces that are applied during the chiropractic manipulation, for example, to try to understand, first of all, what happens during a treatment. And when we do research, to be able to standardize the practices in order to do controlled clinical trials, I think it's very important that we do that, that we pay a lot of attention to what is being done to understand what works better.
So when we start looking at the kind of mosaic of your extraordinary work, which are now many, many papers and many, many different studies, there's something that stands out to me, and I'm sure you probably were way ahead of me in seeing this, and that is the landscape tends to suggest that when we look at the body, and in fact, I think you even spoke to this very eloquently in a paper you wrote not too long ago, I think it was back in 2006, on connective tissue, a body-wide signaling network, that somehow there's this signaling capacity from a mechanical stimulus through the fascia that has a whole body effect that more suggests than the systems biology or network signaling type of phenomena, which is a very different context for maybe physiological response than we have previously been thinking about, which is point of action and point of response. This is more of a general network change in physiological state function. Can you give us some insight how you see this information you're emerging relates to this whole network and systems biology concept?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something I'm very interested in, but again, that is something that is still at the hypothesis level right now, but I think very interesting hypothesis level. Connective tissue is a network. There's no doubt about that. It's an anatomical network because it goes absolutely everywhere in the body, and I like this kind of image of saying you could draw a line from any point of your body, a continuous line, to any other point of your body via connective tissue because it actually surrounds every muscle, every nerve, every blood vessel, every organ. So it is an anatomical network, and in addition, it's a cellular network because the fibroblasts are connected to each other. They make contact with each other, and that's another thing we found by looking at our whole tissue using different confocal microscopy techniques, that we're able to actually see the processes of the fibroblasts touching each other. So, of course, that question of, well, if they're making so many contacts and they form the cellular network, are they talking to each other? And so far, we have not been able to identify, with certainty anyway, any signal that gets transmitted over a significant distance. I'm talking about more than just one cell to the cell immediately adjacent to it. So even though it's a very kind of tempting hypothesis that there might be some kind of a body-wide signaling network, and that's the hypothesis that I put forward in that paper, but so far we have not conclusively tested it one way or another. I can't say that there is or there isn't at this point in time, but we're still looking, and I think that one of the things that acupuncture theory kind of suggests or proposes is that the network of meridians in the body in fact connects the various parts of the body functionally. And because we found this relationship, interesting relationship, anatomical relationship between the connective tissue network and the acupuncture meridian network in terms of just the topography of it, it raises the interesting possibility that what the acupuncturists refer to as qi, which is a kind of what they call it, a life force, or people struggle as to how to describe qi, but some kind of active principle, or you could think that it is perhaps some form of signaling or information exchange or something like that through the acupuncture meridian network. So that was really the hypothesis that I proposed, that perhaps this signaling network does exist, and we're still trying to find out what this qi could be. But right now we don't know.
So that obviously then segues into something I'm sure you've had discussions about, and that is one of the people that worked in the medical school at University of Maryland who was in the integrated medical department that was kind of a methodologist, biostatistician, authored a recent book that appeared last year called Snake Oil Science, in which he was reviewing all the clinical trials that had been on the CAM therapies. And as I recall in that book, he took exception to acupuncture as having any demonstrated proof of outcome when you start looking at it from RCTs. I have some thoughts about those studies and the way he evaluated them, but I'd be interested in your thoughts when we translate from some of your mechanistic work down into the outcome trials in humans. What's your thought about those who criticize that there's no demonstrated proof of concept?
Yeah, this is a very important subject that acupuncture researchers are right now obviously very concerned with. Acupuncture research has reached a point of kind of a paradoxical situation where there's really three big kinds of types of acupuncture studies. One is that people do trials where they compare the effect of acupuncture to, say, no treatment or to standard care, and they find that there's an effect of acupuncture, that acupuncture really helps people. But then when clinical trials compare acupuncture to a sham procedure, they find very little difference between the true acupuncture and the sham acupuncture. And then, on the other hand, when we look at physiological studies where we look at the effect of acupuncture, say, on the brain using neuroimaging, or what I'm doing in connective tissue, or what other people are doing, looking at, for example, inflammatory responses in peripheral tissues, we find that acupuncture does have very clear physiological effects. But what we don't know is what's the relationship between the physiological effects and the therapeutic effects. That's one thing we don't know much about. And the other thing we don't understand is, well, what's the role of the needle in the therapeutic effect? If you can get the same effect with some kind of sham needle, then does that mean that the needles are not doing anything? I think that part of it is that the answer to this sort of paradox is that part of what the sham control trials are doing is they're really asking a very, very specific question. They're saying, well, does it matter if we put the needle in one place versus another place? Or does it matter if we manipulate the needle or not manipulate the needle? So it's very important to understand that in these particular trials, it's really asking a question, and maybe some of these trials are showing us that as far as the therapeutic effect is concerned, maybe some of these factors are, for example, where you put the needle, maybe it doesn't matter that much. And so if a sham control is putting the needle in a non-acupuncture point, for example, and you find just as good an effect, well, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe the needle position is not that important. So I think that we have a long way to go to understand this, but the field of acupuncture is working very hard right now to try to solve these questions. And, you know, I think that within a few more years, hopefully, we'll have some answers. But the relationship between the mechanisms that we're uncovering in terms of the physiological effects of acupuncture and the therapeutic effects, also, I think we have a lot of work to do there to try to better understand that.
So I'm going to follow up with a philosophical question, and there is no obvious right answer to this question, but I just like your opinion, and that is, I'm wondering as I look at this, let's just take for a moment as a thought your proposed argument, or at least hypothesis, that appeared on connective tissue as a body-wide signaling network and the role that acupuncture and other mechanical therapeutics might have on that network. And then ask the question, could it be that the methodology of the RCT is really suspect? Because in part, we have this whole Heisenberg uncertainty principle about what is changing, what are the variables, what are the, you know, the RCT wants to look at univariate type of processes, which it doesn't sound like this falls nicely in the univariate analysis at all. So I'm just wondering, are we painted into the corner with the way that the RCT is done to get a certain negative answer?
That's possible, of course, but I think that there's probably some other really perhaps more basic explanations for why the RCT is not giving us statistically significant differences between the sham control groups and the real verum acupuncture groups. For example, it could be that there are components of the acupuncture treatment, such as the attention, for example, and the time that the acupuncture is spent with the patient, the teaching, the reframing of the problem, all kinds of traditional Chinese diagnosis, for example, the education that takes place during a real acupuncture treatment that really kind of supplements the effect of the needle. And it's very possible that those effects are overpowering in magnitude compared with the effects of the needle themselves. It's really the combination of all of this that causes the therapeutic effect. And if you're trying to isolate the effect of the needle by itself, you're looking at an effect that may be important, but that is small compared with the non-specific effects of the treatment. So I think that we need to really look at all the components of acupuncture treatments besides the needle, the effects of the needles. There may be a synergistic effect, obviously, between all of these things, but, you know, we need to really start looking at what happens during an acupuncture treatment as a whole. So the methodology, the sophistication of the methodology that needs to be developed in order to investigate complex interventions such as acupuncture is quite formidable compared with doing a placebo-controlled trial of just a pharmacological agent, you know. And so I think we're leading the way here. The alternative research, the CAM, you know, complementary and alternative medicine research community is really at the forefront, I think, of research methodology for developing placebo controls. And I think that we're doing that out of necessity because these modalities are so complex. And so I think we're going to really improve our understanding on how to do clinical trials in general via these problems that we're facing.
Well, I want to really compliment you. Your answer that you just gave to my very diffuse and somewhat nonspecific questions was extraordinarily eloquent. Actually, you answered that question better than I could have if I have asked myself my own question. So thank you very much. That was very nicely said. So let me close with one last thought, and that is we've been talking about systems here, which is a very, very extraordinary concept, very complex, and it's sometimes hard to get our heads around this. But I'd like to move it down now, if I could, to, as it works its way down the ladder into smaller and smaller units of functional regulatory control down to the cell level. And as I recall, one of the things that struck me in your 2001 FACIT paper was you had a diagram that talked about how matrix deformation could transmit signals through cells by way of membrane-related conformational changes that then would influence intracellular signal transduction through things like kinase signaling through ERK and other kinase pathways that ultimately would modulate things like inflammatory potential or cell replication or gene expression. Do you think that there is any evidence now that's accumulating to support that model, that there are potential mechanical changes at the cell's cytoskeletal structure that then can be translated through intracellular signal transduction in the cell to gene expression patterns that alter its physiology?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's a very solid body of evidence in favor of this in cultured cells. There's no doubt that this takes place, and we're starting to understand the pathways involved in mechanotransduction using cultured cell models. And so far, what we have done in our ex vivo models is we've confirmed that some of these events do take place, like the cytoskeletal responses of the cells. There's no question that this occurs in tissue in response to the mechanical stimulus, whether it's stretch or using the acupuncture needle. The cells are receiving the mechanical signal. They are changing their cytoskeletal morphology in an active, dynamic manner that can be inhibited using specific cytoskeletal inhibitors of cytoskeletal signaling molecules such as Rho kinase and RAC, and that involve actin and microtubules. Our results are supported by a large body of literature in cultured cells that suggests that applying a force to a very specific part of the cell surface where there are protein complexes that contain integrins These are molecules that are thought to form a mechanical bridge between the cytoskeleton of the cell and the extracellular matrix. And the integrin acts a little bit like a sensor that it allows the cytoskeleton of the cell to respond to the mechanical force in a direct way. And then that can trigger cascades of signaling events. Now, obviously, we have not tested all of these, of course, in our system, but we've tested some of them. And, yeah, our results are very consistent with what has been described in cultured cells, with some differences, however, as I mentioned earlier, that our cell, the morphology, for example, of the cells in whole tissue is different in some ways to that where the cells in the dish. So I think it's important to compare our results to those in cultured cells and see what are the similarities and what are the differences.
Well, I knew before we started this discussion that this was going to be one of the most provocative, interesting, and mind-expanding discussions that I'd had the privilege of having, and it certainly lived up to that thought. Your work is just amazing. I think it's really at the cutting edge of developing a new science as it relates to systems biology and how it pertains to what we used to think of as unprovable hypotheses. I want to really commend you. It's courageous to be involved in this field, and I think you're bringing the best of science with the best of tradition together. So thank you very much, and we're going to follow your work closely because I think it's opening the door to the next generation of evolution in medicine.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and we'll see what happens next.
We certainly will. I'll stay tuned. Best to you, Dr. Langevin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
So wasn't that a treat? What an amazing journey we just were taken along hand in hand with Dr. Langevin on this area of a systems biology look at the interaction between mechanical forces and cellular signaling. I mean, wow, that was extraordinary. And it reminds me in the 26 years now that we've been doing functional medicine update as to how this field has evolved. And I think you can probably see it, that what she was addressing is a new methodology for evaluating at a basic level of scientific inquiry things that for millennia were just considered kind of experientially correct, but we didn't know the reproducibility or the variation or how technologies could be employed with greater senses of positive outcome. And so now those new methodologies, the systems thinking, are connected together with historical records of experience in such a way as to, I think, optimize the translation of this into future clinical practice. What an extraordinary experience we had. Look forward to seeing you in the February issue. Thank you.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis, LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Blank. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.